Today is Monday, January 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, talks between the U.S. and Russia begin Monday in Geneva after a weeks-long standoff.
Russian military exercises and troop deployment on the Ukrainian border will be the backdrop of U.S.-Russia talks Monday in Geneva, led by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman.
Aid workers say an airstrike in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has killed more than 50 people.
An airstrike in Ethiopia's Tigray region reportedly killed 56 people and injured at least 30, including children, in a camp for displaced people. Aid workers told Reuters Saturday.
And Pakistan concludes a month-long campaign to register Afghan refugees and issue them identity cards. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Talks between U.S. and Russian diplomats will begin Monday in Geneva after a weeks-long standoff over Russian troops' deployment near its border with Ukraine. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara has this preview.
Russian military exercises and troop deployment on the Ukrainian border will be the backdrop of U.S.-Russia talks Monday in Geneva, led by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov. Moscow had laid out sweeping demands, including that NATO reduce its presence in Eastern Europe and not admit Ukraine as a member, demands unacceptable to the U.S. and Europe. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
I think that's certainly part of the playbook. It's to put out a list of absolutely non-starter demands and then to claim that the other side is not engaging and then to use that as somehow justification for aggressive action. But the fact of the matter is, Russia knows well what is a non-starter. But there are also areas, there are also subjects, there are also issues where we can engage. We can have dialogue. We can see if we can improve everyone's overall security.
Russia says it is not preparing to invade Ukraine, its ex-Soviet neighbor, and insists that NATO expansion is a threat to its security. Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Not one inch to the east is what we were told in the 1990s. And what happened? We were duped. We were brazenly duped.
The first round of talks will likely be more an airing of grievances and unlikely to produce certainty on Ukraine. John Teft, former U.S. ambassador to Russia and Ukraine.
When it comes down to Ukraine, I don't think anyone knows exactly what President Putin has in mind. I think the Biden administration has done its best to not only rally the allies, to coordinate policy, to signal to Russia its intent to impose pretty draconian sanctions, much more than we've done in the past.
As Putin tries to keep focus on Ukraine, anti-government protests in Kazakhstan, another Russian neighbor, have killed dozens and injured hundreds. Moscow has sent forces to help crack down on the unrest in response to a request by Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev. It's not clear why Tokayev asked for Moscow's help, Secretary Blinken told VOA.
Having said that, I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
The White House has denied reporting that it's developing options to withdraw U.S. forces in Eastern Europe ahead of the talks. Following the Geneva meeting, NATO and the Russia Council will meet in Brussels January 12th, and broader format talks, which include the U.S., NATO, Russia, Ukraine, and other former Soviet states, will continue in Vienna on January 13th. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Top Russian and U.S. officials have held a working dinner in Geneva as part of the kickoff to a string of meetings in three European cities this week, with bilateral ties at low ebb over Russia's military buildup near Ukraine. Diplomatic officials say the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov and other Russian officials arrived on Sunday evening for a meeting at a residence of the U.S. ambassador to the Conference on Disarmament. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also says he does not expect breakthroughs in U.S.-Russia security talks this week, but hopes to find some common ground amid a crisis in Ukraine. He stresses that progress will be difficult, if not impossible, amid Moscow's large military buildup at its border with Ukraine.
If we're actually going to make progress in these talks, starting next week, I don't think we're going to see any breakthroughs next week. We're going to listen to their concerns, they'll listen to our concerns, and we'll see if there are grounds for progress. But to make actual progress, it's very hard to see that happening when there's an ongoing escalation, when Russia has a gun to the head of Ukraine with 100,000 troops near its borders, the possibility of doubling that on very short order. So if we're seeing de-escalation, if we're seeing a reduction in tension, that is the kind of environment in which we could make real progress and, again, address concerns, reasonable concerns on both sides.
Kazakhstan's health ministry says 164 people, including a four-year-old girl, have been killed in protests in the past week. It is the worst unrest in a Central Asian country since the former Soviet Republic gained independence 30 years ago. The office of President Kasym Jomart Tokayev says order has been restored and that the government has regained control of all buildings that were taken over by the protesters. Some of the buildings were set on fire. A Russian TV station reports that sporadic gunfire was heard Sunday in Almaty, the largest city in Kazakhstan. Tokayev said Friday he had authorized police and the military to shoot to kill to restore order. Russian paratrooper commander Andrei Sedikov said on Sunday that a Russian-led alliance of ex-Soviet states, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, had arrived in Kazakhstan by request of President Tokayev and will stay until the situation is, quote, perfectly stable, unquote. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken says Washington is seeking clarification from Kazakhstan officials on why they need to call in Russian-led security forces to resolve domestic unrest, and he has denounced the government's shoot-to-kill order. In an interview on ABC's This Week on Sunday, Blinken said the order is wrong and should be rescinded. Blinken also said he does not expect breakthroughs in U.S.-Russian security talks this week, but hopes to find common ground amid a crisis in Ukraine. Blinken's comments lowering expectations for the upcoming talks echoed Russia's hard line on Sunday that it would not make any concessions under U.S. pressure at talks this week on the Ukraine crisis. He stressed the progress will be difficult, if not impossible.
We've made clear that we expect the Kazakh government to deal with protesters in ways that respects their rights, that pulls back from violence at the same time. The shoot-to-kill order, to the extent it exists, is wrong and should be rescinded. And Kazakhstan has the ability to maintain law and order, to defend the institutions of the state, but to do so in a way that respects the rights of peaceful protesters and also addresses the concerns that they've raised, economic concerns, some political concerns. We have real questions about why it was necessary to call in this organization that Russia leads and is a part of.
A former anti-terror chief has been arrested over protests in Kazakhstan, Associated Press correspondent Charles Deladesma reports.
Karim Asimov, the former head of the Counterintelligence and Anti-Terror Agency, has been detained on charges of attempted government overthrow in the wake of violent protests that the president of Kazakhstan has blamed on foreign-backed terrorists. The authorities say security forces have killed over 20 demonstrators in this week's unrest, and close to the same amount of law enforcement officers have died too. The Interior Ministry says more than 4,400 people have been arrested. The protests in the Central Asian nation are the most widespread since independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. I'm Charles Tuladesma.
Aid workers and eyewitnesses are telling media an airstrike in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has killed more than 50 people. The Reuters news agency reports at least 30 others have been wounded after a camp for the internally displaced was hit Friday night. Telmo DeWitt reports from Addis Ababa.
An air strike in Ethiopia's Tigray region reportedly killed 56 people and injured at least 30, including children, in a camp for displaced people. Aid workers told Reuters Saturday, citing eyewitnesses and the local authorities. Ethiopian government officials have not confirmed the reported strike that hit an area of the Debi town near the border with Eritrea. Aid workers, who asked not to be named because they are not authorized to speak to the media, told Reuters this strike occurred Friday night. An aid worker said victims were brought to Shireshul General Hospital, adding the camp was a residence for elderly women and children. The reported air strike happened after the government released detained Tigray People's Liberation Front senior leaders and other politicians Friday night in an attempt to curb the country's crisis. Ethiopia's government communication service announced the release of Sabahat Nega, one of the founders of the TPLF, Abay Waldu, a former head of Tigray region, Jawar Mohammed, Iskender Nega, and others. Speaking to the state-run news agency Saturday, Ethiopia's Minister for Justice, Gideon Timotheus, said the individuals were released after the government dropped criminal charges against them. Their charges were dropped to facilitate the national dialogue set to happen soon, he said. As you know, the country has established a commission for national dialogue, and releasing them will make the process more inclusive and valid too. Ethiopia introduced the process of creating a national dialogue commission in December. Justice Minister Timotheus says the government wants every part of society in the country to take part in the process. In remarks Saturday, he revealed the government has also dropped charges against Debretsion Gebremichael, Tigray's region head, and five other TPLF officials. But there is no confirmation whether the TPLF will be part of the upcoming national dialogue. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has welcomed the decision to release detainees. He has called on the two parties to end hostilities and launch a credible and inclusive national dialogue. Tigray forces announced in December they were pulling out of parts of Ethiopia's Amhara and Afar regions as part of a ceasefire agreement. In a later address to the United Nations Secretary General at that time, Gebremichael said demands, which includes establishment of a no-fly zone over Tigray's airspace. Aid agencies told Reuters this week at least 146 people have been killed and 213 injured in airstrike in Tigray since October 18. But the Ethiopian government denies targeting civilians during a 14-month conflict with Tigray forces. Galmudait for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Mali's military government proposed in December a 5-year extension of the transition to civilian rule after originally agreeing to a period of 18 months. Protesters gathered Saturday in Bamako to call for a return to democracy ahead of a meeting about Mali of the Economic Community of West African States on Sunday in Accra. This is the first public demonstration since the government's announcement of a 5-year plan, a contrast to the many pro-military demonstrations that have been held this year. Reporter Annie Rosenberg has the details.
About 100 protesters gathered this afternoon at Bamako's Martyrs Monument to demand a swift return to civilian rule after Mali's military government proposed a 5-year transition plan in December with the next presidential elections in 2026. The Martyrs Monument commemorates March 26, 1991, when government soldiers fired on pro-democracy protesters, killing many. This assembly marks the first anti-transition demonstration since the government announced the 5-year plan. Ibrahim Khalilu Thera, one of the demonstration organizers, said military leaders proposed a 5-year transition period without consulting the people.
En réalité, s'ils avaient proposé au moins une transition, une période courte de 6 mois, le peuple pouvait comprendre.
In reality, he says, if they had proposed at least a transition of a short period of 6 months, the people could have understood. But we can tell that these people don't have the will to organize elections. Not for February, because they could have organized for February. But there weren't prior arrangements. There weren't preparations. There wasn't the political will. Sina Thera, 23, a student at the University of Bamako, was originally in support of the military government when they first took power in August 2020 in a coup d'etat that ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The August 2020 coup followed months of anti-government protests in Bamako, some that ended in the killing of protesters by security forces. When the current military leaders first came to power, they were met by large crowds and widespread support in the streets of Bamako.
Avant, je les soutenais beaucoup. Ouais, parce que ils ont venu parachever la lutte.
He says that before, he supported them a lot, because they came to finish the fight started by the Malian population. Once the fight is done, though, and the fight was victorious, it's time. The promise they made is very sacred. They set a deadline. A coalition of major political parties rejected the military government's 5-year transition proposition earlier this week. Mohamed Ag Asordi, a political analyst and consultant, says it's not so important whether or not the march Saturday has a large number of people, because for months there was a complete lack of opposition. Some time ago, he says, there were only supporters of the transition that could be seen here and there. There's now an emergence of a new poll, a new opposition that's organizing itself. And people listen to what they're saying. It's just the beginning. There have been press conferences. Now they're starting to demonstrate on the ground. And I think there will be more actions in the future in this sense. He adds that everything will depend, however, on what happens this Sunday, January 9th, when the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, a 15-nation regional bloc with a mandate to promote economic integration, holds an extraordinary summit on Mali in Accra, which may lead to an agreement between ECOWAS leaders and Mali's military government on a shortened transition period. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Pakistan has concluded a months-long campaign to register Afghan refugees and issue them identity cards that will protect and safeguard their interests. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The government-run campaign, supported by the UN Refugee Agency, began in mid-April. The registration drive has updated the data of some 1.4 million Afghan refugees. This is the first large-scale effort to verify the status of refugees in Pakistan in the last 10 years. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says the refugees are given so-called smart identity cards that legitimize their status and facilitate their access to humanitarian aid and other benefits.
The new identity cards are an essential protection tool for Afghan refugees and give them the faster and safer access to health and education facilities and to financial services as well. This drive also provided an opportunity for Afghan refugees to flag any specific protection needs for vulnerabilities.
The UNHCR reports more than 300,000 Afghans have fled to Pakistan since the Taliban took over their country in August. Their situation is precarious, as most have entered the country illegally and may be liable for deportation. The United Nations warns Afghanistan is becoming one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. It notes 24.4 million people, more than half of the population, need life-saving humanitarian assistance. It says more than 9 million Afghans are displaced within the country with little prospect of returning soon to the homes they fled. Baluch says more than 40 verification sites were set up across Pakistan during the registration drive last year. He says mobile registration vans sought out Afghan refugees living in remote areas. He says a mass information campaign also was carried out to explain the purpose of the campaign to Afghan refugees. He says this effort has paid off with large numbers participating.
Among them, there were 200,000 children under the age of five who were registered by their refugee parents. More than 700,000 new smart identity cards have also been issued to date. The remaining cards will be printed and distributed in early 2022. These cards are valid until 30th of June 2023.
Baluch says the campaign is part of a wider effort to assist and protect Afghan refugees. Gathering more detailed information about the refugees, he says, will enable the government and aid agencies to better tailor assistance to them. In addition, he says, it will facilitate support for those refugees who decide to return home when conditions in Afghanistan allow. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, New York City officials say that at least 19 people, including nine children, died in a fire Sunday at a Bronx apartment building in one of the worst places in the city in decades. The death toll was confirmed by Stefan Ringo, a senior advisor to Mayor Eric Adams. Ringo said more than 5 dozen people were injured and 13 people were still in critical conditions in the hospital. The commissioner of the city's fire department, Daniel Negro, says the majority of victims were suffering from severe smoke inhalation. He says firefighters found victims on every floor who were suffering from cardiac and respiratory arrest. He said the accident is, quote, unprecedented, unquote, and that they expect numerous fatalities. Fire officials say approximately 200 firefighters responded to the scene at the Twin Park Apartments, a 19-story building on East 181st Street. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afoy in Washington. Greece this week takes delivery of an ancient fragment that once adorned the Parthenon Temple, the country's most important archaeological site. The return from a museum in Italy is seen as the strongest nod yet to the British Museum, which holds the largest collection of Pergamon scriptures and has refused for centuries to return the antiquities to their ancient home. Anthony Karasava has a report read by VOA's Penny Dixon.
The marble fragment will be unveiled at the Acropolis Museum Monday, displayed in a full-size representation of the Parthenon's frieze. The return is part of a groundbreaking loan deal signed between the Acropolis Museum and the Antonio Salinas Regional Archaeological Museum in Sicily, where the artifact has been on display since the 19th century. The Parthenon fragment, depicting the foot of a goddess, will be lent for a four-year period in exchange for a 5th century B.C. headless statue of the goddess Athena and an 8th century B.C. amphora as part of an extensive cultural exchange agreement. The loan period may be extended a further 4 years, and the fragments moved to Greece could eventually become permanent.
Πρόκειται πάνω απ' όλα για μια πολιτιστική ανταλλαγή στη βάση της οποίας μπορούν να οργανωθούν οι διεθνείς εκθέσεις.
Speaking to a Greek translator, Sicily's Counselor for Culture, Alberto Simona, says this is an important cultural exchange that can pave the way for even bigger international exhibits organized by the Salinas Museum and the Acropolis Museum. Experts in Greece say the loan deal adds to mounting pressure on Britain to follow suit with the so-called Elgin Marbles, a massive collection of sculptures assembled by Thomas Bruce, the 7th Earl of Elgin, who in the early 1800s was the British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, which then controlled Greece. Britain bought them from Elgin in 1816 after a parliamentary inquiry into the legitimacy of his ownership. The dispute marks one of the longest-standing cultural rows in history, with Athens demanding for decades that the British Museum return the marble masterpieces to Greece. Greeks have accused the late British aristocrat of cultural theft. Last week, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis made a new bid for the return of the sculptures as the Acropolis Museum installed 10 fragments of the Parthenon frieze stored in the capital's archaeological museum.
Για μια υπόθεση πολιτική, ηθική, με διαστάσεις παγκόσμιες.
The return of the Parthenon sculptures from the British Museum, he said, is a political and ethical issue with international implications. The Prime Minister said the return is all about healing a wound created violently and illegally by Elgin. Mitsotakis raised the issue in talks with his British counterpart, Boris Johnson, late last year, offering to lend some Greek historical treasures to the British Museum. The Prime Minister's office has since said the offer is a matter for the British Museum to decide. It added, however, that the marbles were bound to remain in Britain, arguing they were legally acquired and not the subject of an ownership dispute. For Anthony Karasava in Athens, I'm Penny Dixon, VOA News.
Over 2 decades ago, Natalie Peruse was hit by a car in New York. While recovering from the accident, she went to Austria, where she saw bells on necks of cows. And that simple vision prompted a huge change in her life. Anna Nelson has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Bells are magical to me. The shape is like a dress. It's just visually like magic. The more I researched, the more I was fascinated. I have about 700 bells in my collection.
Natalia Peruse is a New York-based musical saw and bell player and busker. The recipient of multiple musical awards, Peruse doesn't shy away from playing on the streets and is always glad to talk about her bell collection.
Elephant bell. Bicycle bells. The whole story started from these bells, which I collected from tourist stores in Austria.
Peruse used to be a dancer. She interned at the Martha Graham Dance Company and was sure her future would be connected to dance. But everything changed in a split second. She got hit by a car on a New York street as she was making her way home after dance practice. She was badly hurt, both physically and emotionally. The prospect of dancing professionally started to feel very distant and unrealistic. In an attempt to cheer Peruse up, her parents took her on a trip to Austria.
While in Austria, we rented a car, and we were driving, and through the open windows of the cars, I could hear the sound of bells. So I said to my father as a joke, all these different cowherds, they have different pitches of bells. Wouldn't it be fun to collect a whole octave of these cowbells and play them?
Peruz just knew she had to learn how to play the bells. She never had teachers. She read old books, studied old photographs, and used her imagination to do the rest of her learning.
Cowbell ringing is primarily Austrian and Swiss. Possibly you can also find it in France. But anywhere else in the world, these particular brand of cowbells, they're really just in those countries. Possibly there may be some ringer here or there in other countries, like I'm in New York.
Ringing cowbells is hard work. The musician stands in front of an 8-foot-long table and constantly moves from one end to the other, ringing the various bells in front of him or her. Peruz says there's a certain choreography to that, a certain dance-like structure, making it physically quite demanding. In New York, she has been the only solo bell ringer.
Ernest Hemingway wrote, "For whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." Oh, I think the bell tolls for everybody. All of us. There's no escaping the bells.
For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Junior Dwapo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hong Kong, a city that once enjoyed some of the freest media in Asia, is being deprived of its last independent journalism voices. Most recently, Citizen News, a small online news site in Hong Kong, known for its in-depth coverage of courts and local politics, ceased operations on January 3rd. The chief editor cited concerns over the increasing number of arrests of independent journalists and editors in Hong Kong. On December 29th, Hong Kong authorities raided and arrested 7 senior staff at Stan News, forcing yet another of the few remaining bastions of free and independent media to cease operations. The 7 were arrested on suspicion of conspiring to publish seditious material, according to the police. In June, Apple Daily, one of Hong Kong's best-known pro-democracy newspapers, was forced to close after repeated police raids of its newsroom and the arrests of several editors and its founder, Jimmy Lai. Mr. Lai was recently charged with a new accusation of sedition related to the newspaper, as were 6 other former employees. Mr. Lai had already been sentenced to 20 months in prison for his support of the pro-democracy movement. He now faces up to life in prison with the additional charges. Hong Kong returned to the People's Republic of China, or PRC, rule in 1997, with the promise that individual rights and a free press would be protected. But Beijing has steadily eroded these freedoms since imposing a national security law on Hong Kong in 2020. In a written statement, Secretary of State Antony Blinken declared, "Journalism is not sedition." He called on the PRC and Hong Kong authorities to cease targeting Hong Kong's free and independent media and to immediately release those journalists and media executives who have been unjustly detained and charged. Freedom of expression, including media freedom and access to information provided by an independent media, are critical to prosperous and secure societies, said Secretary Blinken. These freedoms enabled Hong Kong to flourish as a global center for finance, trade, education, and culture. By silencing independent media, PRC and local authorities undermine Hong Kong's credibility and viability. A confident government that is unafraid of the truth embraces a free press.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the voice of America, Washington.